Here's another business success story. A craft brewery called The Garage Project, based in Wellington and founded by Pete Gillespie with his brother Ian and his mate Joss Ruffle. Or is it Ruffell?
Ruffle.
Pete Gillespie's here, you can tell. He's the brewer of often fairly unusual beers. Rum and raisin beer, with a beer with grape skin, a fermented Japanese condiment beer, a beer with pomegranate or habanero chili. The labels are arty and probably collectible. So it's been 8 years and over 400 beers, says Gillespie in a commemorative book called The Art of Beer. And yes, here he is now. He's going to be playing favourites. Hello, Peter Gillespie.
Hello, Kim. Thank
you for
having me.
It's a very beautiful book and it's all very, you know, highly illustrated with the beautiful... The beautiful, beautiful labels that you've got. Did you set off to do a kind of an art project beer? Hey?
Not really, no. I mean, the book is great fun, and it's great fun because of the art that's in it. It's a celebration of all of those artists, many of whom are from Wellington, most of whom are from New Zealand. So it's a huge kind of testament to the kind of creativity that we have around here. We did start off with this idea of... I don't know, it's very important to me that every beer we produce has its own character. You know,
But do they really? I mean, I'm not the right person to be talking to about this, obviously, but, you know, I was enthralled to begin with, you know, when beer started appearing, promising to taste like coriander and chocolate.
Yeah.
I never did, really.
Really? What, yeah. The ones that you tasted didn't taste yeah. like that? I mean, what I love about beer has always...
Suggestibility is it, isn't it?
No. Really? I think that you can definitely get those flavours in there. I mean, that's the thing about beer. Beer has always used whatever is available to achieve balance. So wine has always been, you crush grapes, you ferment the juice. But beer is very different. Beer is about balance. I mean, it's always sweet because you're going to get that sweetness from the malt. But then it's about creating some kind of balance to that sweetness. And people have always used whatever is at hand. So, I mean, they used to use all sorts of herbs, bundles of different herbs called gruet. They would use spices.
Called what?
Gruet.
Gruet.
Gruet, mm-hmm. Yeah. So you would buy it, and it had all sorts of interesting, sometimes psychoactive plants in it, wormwood. Things that they use for absinthe used to be the same kind of herbal concoction that people would put in beer to give it bitterness, to then balance that sweetness. You can also use savoury to balance the sweetness, so smokiness. Sourness is another element that people can use. People also added fruit. So unlike other alcoholic beverages, beer has always had this kind of creative element to it. It's not new. In fact, it's very old. What happened for a little while there was people discovered if you used hops, which were one of the kind of herbal additions people would use, if you used hops, you also got microbial stability. So you could guarantee your beer would not become sour because hops will prevent things like lactic bacteria.
Are they some kind of antiseptic?
Yes.
Are they?
Yeah. As well as giving you aromatics and bitterness. So they kind of became the hegemonic thing to use in beer, and everything else kind of died out. But there is that tradition of using just about anything you can find to achieve balance and flavour.
How many brands of hops, how many varieties of hops would you use?
Do we use an enormous number? I mean, what's fascinating about hops is that every country has their own terroir, their own character to the hops. We use a lot of American hops, British hops, German hops, but New Zealand hops are incredibly sought after.
How many varieties do we grow here?
How many varieties? Oh, probably over a dozen.
Right.
You know, I mean, there are some superstars among that little gang. Things like Nelson Sovin, Motueka, they're all named after kind of little areas around where they grow on at the top of the South Island.
And can you tell which hop is
Absolutely.
Used for which beer?
Absolutely.
Right.
They all have their own...
It's that clear.
They have their own character. And they all, I mean, some of them should be used in different ways in the brewing process. But New Zealand really is at the forefront internationally. They're renowned. We have brewers coming from all over the world for the hop harvest to try the hops and try and secure some, because there's not an awful lot of the hops available.
So the only thing that all beers have in common is that they are made from hop.
No. So some beers have no hop. You can make beer without hops. The only thing that they have in common is that they're using some kind of grain as the base, a malted grain. So you can imagine the
makes them beer and not whiskey? Oh, they're not distilled.
They're not distilled. Right. You can imagine the first person that discovered that, you know, if you had grain and it got wet and then it fermented and you tasted the juice and the juice made you feel nice, which, can you imagine back then when life was so atrocious? Yeah. It would have been wonderful.
Yeah.
And people used to think of it as a kind of a quasi-religious experience because no one really understood fermentation. No one thought about yeast. People would like...
What are you saying? Drinking your beer is not a quasi-spiritual experience?
It can be, absolutely.
Yeah. You were a brewer for ages before Garage Project, right?
For about a decade, yes.
And you worked in...
I brewed in the UK. Yeah, at
Breakspear. Which is kind of famous.
It was very famous. Unfortunately, it shut down while I was there.
How come?
Nothing to do with me.
No.
How come? Because the real estate that the building was on, I mean, it was the most beautiful brewery. It was built at that time in the kind of, you know, 18th, 19th century where they built industrial architecture to be beautiful. It had stained glass windows and beautiful spiral staircases. I mean, it was incredible. It was a wonderful place to start brewing. So romantic. But the real estate in Henley-on-Thames was probably among the most sought after the south of England.
Was it actually on the river?
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. I mean, it was amazing. And so they sold the brewery. It had been going for 250 years. There were people working there whose parents had worked there as well. It was incredible. Like a kind of almost like a sheltered workshop as well. There's some real characters there.
Did they turn it into apartments?
They turned it into apartments, yeah. They sold the beer brand to another, like a beer brand group who continue to brew Breakspears. You might see it around, but it's no longer brewed at the brewery. And they turned it into flats.
What took you to brewing beer in the first place?
Took me to brewing beer?
Did you do it DIY it for a while?
So some of my earliest memories are home brewing with my grandpa. So he used to home brew, and I remember the experience of brewing with him.
Where was he?
In Scotland.
Which bit?
Falkirk. And I know there was always a real magic to it. I still, to this day, I'll be in the brewery and just... I'll get a little smell, like even just almost like a note, and it'll just take me back to that. And it's such a fond memory. And I did that when I was tiny. I remember I bought my grandpa a spoon to use in his home brewing, and I thought it was the biggest. It was a wooden spoon, and I thought it was the biggest spoon I'd ever seen, ever. And he sadly, obviously, died a long while later, and we were tidying his house up, and I found that spoon, and it was tiny.
Oh.
So I must have been so small to
Isn't
think it was
Isn't that strange,
enormous...
the childhood memories? That's happened
I know.
A lot.
I know.
My grandparents' house, I always thought was a mansion.
Yes!
Until I went back there.
And you go back and it
Perfectly
feels tiny.
Ordinary small house.
But it's really interesting. I mean, I know, alcohol can obviously be very destructive in some people's lives.
I thought
lives.
You were going to say alcohol can clearly distort your memories.
It can do that as well, absolutely. But my memories as a child and kind of growing up around, especially my grandparents, I mean, you know, it was always about fun. You know, in the evenings, people would go off and retrieve, like, bottles of homebrew, and they'd come in and the music would go on. They always listened to jazz, and it was always just, I don't know, fun.
You have, this leads, thank you, to the first track you have chosen, which is Peggy Lee.
Yes.
Do I Love You? Norma Dolores Ekstrom was her name.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't even know that.
Yeah, this from was Scandi roots.
This was a real favourite of my grandparents. And I do just remember that. The music, laughter, lots of stories, always stories. No politics, though. My family had quite extreme and polarised politics. So as long as you didn't talk about that, it was all okay. As long as you just drank beer and listened to Peggy Lee.
Interesting that they drank beer and not whiskey.
Yes.
Or possibly both?
No, beer drinkers, not whiskey drinkers.
Okay.
I think my nana had banned my grandfather from drinking whiskey.
There might have been that. Let's hear Peggy Lee.
Lovely.
God. Do I love you? Do I? Doesn't one and one make two? Do I love you? Do I? Does July need a sky? have blue. Would I miss you? Would I, if you ever should go away? If the sun should desert the day, what would life be? Will I leave you? Never. Could the ocean leave the shore? Will I worship you forever? Isn't heaven forevermore? Do I love you? Do I? Oh, my dear, it's so easy to see. Don't you know that I do? Don't I show you I do? Just as you love me.
Do I love you? I'm talking to Pete Gillespie, who is the brewer for Garage Project. The brewer or one of the brewers?
Oh, we've got quite a few brewers now.
The founder brewer?
Yes.
Yeah. You came to New Zealand when?
Initially when I was five. So my family moved out from Scotland. We moved to Wellington first, and we were in Wellington for a few years, and then moved down to Christchurch.
And you went back to the UK to work.
I finished school in Christchurch and left the same day. Christchurch and I didn't necessarily get on very well.
You want to explain why? Conservative?
Very conservative. I have a love-hate relationship with it. I mean, there's a lot of things to love about Christchurch. It is very conservative. I found it very white and very conservative. But for every, you know, cities like that, that have that conservatism always have, like, the pendulum swings the other way as well. And there's always a very interesting kind of alternative and art scene in places like that. And I did love that. I thought that was fun. But no, I left the day I finished school. I went to Australia. I mooched around, went to Europe, the UK.
When you say mooched around, you really mean mooched around, or did you do something useful?
I really did.
Because you did get a PhD in the end in Australia, so you've kind of been doing too much mooching.
I felt like I probably should settle down and do something. But life has that funny way sometimes of just sort of sweeping you along. I don't think I was actively guiding myself. I ended up doing a journalism course, but then didn't really have an enormous amount of passion to start doing that. And I got offered to do honours, so I kind of did that. And then a PhD got offered to me, and I sort of did that, all without really actively...
What was your PhD in?
I was actually looking at the role of risk-taking in the construction of young men's personal narrative. It was a bloody good topic.
Yeah.
Kept me interested. So it was looking at young men from different subcultural groups and how risk-taking of various types was sort of integrated into that idea of their personal narrative, how they thought about themselves and presented themselves to other people.
Yeah. Did you have a conclusion?
Oh, lots. I mean, it was an enormous tome, which is now tucked safely away in a library, and I'm sure no one ever looks at it.
Was risk-taking part of your growing up?
I think it was, yes. And I think doing a PhD, probably excess. I quite enjoyed excess in any form. But I think doing that PhD, strangely, was almost exercised some of those things, which was quite good. So I talked to, you know, young men, young drug takers, young gay men, this is in Sydney, people who actually enjoy that physical risk-taking, you know, throwing themselves off things. Young men from, there's a fascinating culture in Australia, the bachelor and spinster balls. Do you know about that at all?
I don't.
B&S balls, obviously rural Australia, very...
Oh, this is where they're short of women and they ship them in.
Well, no. So, I mean, young people in rural Australia so thinly spread, you know, what are your chances of getting together and meeting anybody? So they have these bachelor and spinster balls,
okay,
which, you know, are a throwback to sort of, you know, early colonial times, and everyone would dress up in, you know, tuxedo. But over the years, they've morphed. So they have this amazing subculture where these guys and girls drive these Holden utes, and they cover them with lights and stickers and bull bars. They're really distinctive, almost like mods, you know, in 60s London. And they drive literally hundreds of kilometres, if not further, to go to these bachelor and spinster balls. And they turn up, everyone beautifully attired. And, you know, it looks so highbrow. But then the experiences, the B&S balls are the most... You know, everyone just gets blind drunk. They're the most kind of like base, almost orgiastic. And there's this real element of risk taking it. People will do circle work in their utes and ride on the bonnets, bonnet surf. It's an opportunity to show everyone your kind of your bravado and your ability to kind of be, to drink as much and to do the most dangerous things possible. Yeah,
and do you think that this is just part of the ritual, our ritual? Our modern-day ritual of coming of age.
I mean, that's obviously a very extreme example of it. But I think, you know, that definitely is a part. I mean, people want to... Everyone wants to feel special. Everyone wants to feel like their life is a little bit more interesting and, you know, dramatic than the norm. And I think risk-taking definitely plays a part in it. But what's also fascinating is what some of these young men felt. You know, other people would think what they were doing was a risk, but they were adamant that what they were doing was not a risk.
No, because they had bulletproof.
But also they had these sort of amazing kind of knowledges, you know, often sort of like very specific to those subcultures, you know, how to do drugs without, you know, necessarily being at risk. If you didn't have the knowledge, you'd be at risk, but I'm not at risk because I do have this. It's very interesting.
And do you think that they really did have the knowledge, or is that
again? In some cases, yes. Ah. I mean, in some cases, obviously, you know, there was knowledge that would be, you know, reduce risk, not eliminate. But then the most interesting thing too was occasionally, you know, something would happen, these kind of terrible epiphanal moments where something would happen to somebody where they lost a friend or they almost died, and it would like tear this kind of narrative apart, and they'd have to, you know, reassemble their life and make sense of it all again. Those little moments popped up quite a lot in the interviews I did. Mm. And it's very interesting to see how people then presented their life post that event.
Well, you make good use of that PhD.
That's got bugger all to do with brewing, doesn't it?
Dr. Gillespie. So after that, you roamed around for a while and didn't know what to do with yourself.
So I finished the PhD, but by that point, I myself had this kind of epiphany that I really didn't feel like I just didn't feel like I was passionate about what I was doing, and that it would be all too easy just to kind of wash along, you know, things happening and just going along with the flow. And I was home brewing because it was something that I still loved, and I felt like really that was something I was passionate about. And I felt as well quite enamored with this idea about actually doing work where you produce something physically at the end of the day. So, you know, at the end of the day, you've made something. And there's something about beer, too, that's really special because you make it, but then you can share it with somebody. Mm. And there's a real, I mean, I think as a brewer, one of the greatest pleasures is when you give somebody a beer that you've made and you just see that they love it. You know, just the joy that can come from that. I mean, I find that immensely satisfying. So I had this moment where I decided that's it, I really do need to pursue this. And so, yeah.
Did you go and work for Breakspears?
I did at that point.
And then in Hepworth with a view to becoming your own brewer?
I think I always had the feeling that I wanted to have my own brewery to be able to be creative. But I also wanted to, I didn't want to just jump into it. I wanted to learn. And I think I always felt like, you know, maybe if I found the right place, I might settle down and work for other people. But I think the reality of that, so probably always wanted to have my own thing.
Could you have done what you're doing without going through Breakspears and Hepworth, et cetera?
I don't think so. I mean, for me personally, I think there's a lot. It's really interesting. I mean, I went obviously through Breakspears. That's English real ale. I then moved back to Australia.
When you say real ale, is that the equivalent of craft beer?
No, it's much more.
What's real ale got going for it that makes it real ale?
So it's, in fact, like quite a very traditional form of beer making.
So they wouldn't put, you know, habanero chili
in it? No, so they tended not to put unusual things in there. In England, what they still use casks. So, I mean, like a barrel, and then they're made of metals, but they brew the beer, put it into the barrel. The barrel gets then sent to the pub. And, I mean, you know, in England, they have the hand pulls. I mean, it's fascinating because the beer is alive and continuing to develop in that barrel. It's not like it's been pasteurized and filtered and, yeah, and just sort of like put in a keg and it'll turn up the same no matter what. The quality of that beer is dependent
it's
also
like raw
on the publican.
Milk,
yeah,
as
and,
one
and
might
the,
say.
The publican who looks after that beer will have a huge impact on the quality of it as well. So it's fascinating. And then I moved back to Australia. My partner and I had a baby when we were in the UK. And I think, you know, after a while, we just decided that bringing up a kid, we'd like to be back in Australia, which is where I'd met her. Moved back to Australia and I brewed in Sydney, the Malt Shovel, for a while. And brewing, you know, in these bigger breweries, even if they're craft, I mean, it's a funny word, craft. We've stopped using it. I don't really like to call myself a craft brewer. I'm just
don't
a brewer.
You?
No, I think just a brewer.
Why? Because you think it's pretentious?
I think it is a little pretentious and it then creates
artisanal.
This,
it artisanal creates, do it for you.
It creates this division too between little breweries and big breweries. And I think that it's not helpful to create that division. Mm. I mean, big breweries do a wonderful job of creating beer that is of a high quality and you can guarantee it's the same every time.
The
and
same people, every time.
And people love that beer as well. And yeah, who has the right to tell anyone that they shouldn't love those beers? So I think, you know, I think we're all just brewers. Everyone's making beer. And we don't just make beer with habanero chilies and rose water and watermelon. We make very, very simple beers as well. I love all beer, the spectrum.
Do you love all beer?
I think so.
Do you? Because even, I mean, a rare person who can say that. You know, I mean, wine
I think
lovers
I can,
don't like all wine. And
I think that I can try anything, and if it's a good example of it, then you can enjoy what the person has done. Absolutely.
You obviously do try and get the beer to be consistent.
Oh, absolutely.
Because you don't want people to say, yeah, you know, I ordered this and he gave me something entirely different. But and how do you do that?
Well, that's, I mean, it's interesting. A beer brewing is a very interesting mixture of art and science. And there is a real science and a methodology to making sure that you get that ability to repeat beers, to make them the same. And that's, I think, what I really learned from working at much larger brewers overseas, that ability to just have that repeatability with brews is so important.
Let's go to a track called Golden Brown, which sounds like you've named a beer after it.
I have.
By the Stranglers, which is an English punky,
it's an English
rocky,
yeah, post-punk band. I love this tune. Do you know it?
I don't know whether I know it until I hear it. I can't remember. Right. Any particular reason why you've chosen this one?
I think just because it's a tune that I love. It's a tune that I loved when I was younger, in my early days. It's a tune that I continue to love. It's this lovely mix of, you know, classical and post-punk. It's I think it's quite haunting, and it's got this lovely, the lovely little refrain, "Never a frown with Golden Brown." I do love that.
Hey.
Golden brown, texture like sun, blaze me down. With my mind she runs throughout the night. No need to fight. just like the last on the ship, tied to the mast. Two distant lands, takes both my hands, never a frown with golden brown. Temptress, through the ages she's heading west, from far away, stays for a day, never a frown with golden brown.
Yeah, of course, as soon as it starts, you remember that song, Golden Brown, an ode to heroin, as somebody informs me, as well as you. Why the beard? I mean, beards generally, generic beards.
I wondered if you'd bring this
well,
up.
Of course. You know, you go into these, you go into the place where you sell your Garage Project beer, your wee bar thing, your wee barry thing.
In fact, we're talking about the important issues.
Yeah, and everybody, there's no one in there without a beard.
I'll tell you, I had an awful moment of existential angst a couple of years ago where I went over to America to the Craft Brewers Conference, and I walked in, and I always thought of myself as an individual, but I walked in and I swear to God, it felt, have you ever seen that movie Being John Malkovich?
Yes.
And suddenly everybody is John Malkovich. I walked in, everyone looked identical to me, and I thought, oh my God, I'm not an individual. I don't know. The beard originally occurred because I was working at Garage Project. You know, in those early days of a business where it's just so blindingly terrifying, and you're just working every single hour of the day hoping.
You never got time to shave.
I didn't shave.
Is that what you're saying?
14, 16 hours a day. I mean, I didn't smell too bad because obviously I have a partner and she has certain standards.
Right.
But, you know, the beard just grew because I was working, you know, weekends all day, and it just happened. It looked horrible for quite a long time because I hadn't done anything to it. And then,
I wonder if it's something to do with, because I was talking to Tim Brown from Allbirds earlier in the programme, and Allbirds have become terribly, terribly popular in the Valley, in San Francisco, because they're very plain. And if you wear fancy gear, people think, oh, they're not concentrating on the job very much.
And you're right.
So if you don't pay attention to that stuff, you're seen as a virtue signal.
Yeah.
In Silicon Valley. Is that what the beards might be?
I don't know.
You know, I'm just too into my beard to bother shaving.
It's just cultural, and it has become. I mean, I'd like to think that I just have my beard because I like it. My children wouldn't want me. I shaved it off a while ago. I just felt like, you know, time
not
for
yourself.
A change.
Did you feel like not yourself afterwards?
It was kind of strange.
Yeah.
My chin disappeared for a start.
You discovered you didn't have a chin.
That's
in
right.
Fact, no
yeah,
chin
yeah,
at
yeah.
all.
But no, I think it's my partner's become used to it. My children have. There we go.
All right.
It's there.
Yeah. Nevertheless, the ubiquity of the beard and the beer brigade is pretty striking.
It is true.
I think so. You could have ended up in Australia. You started to set up a brewery in the Blue Mountains.
Yes.
And New Zealanders would love hearing this story because, of course, we think that we're undone by bureaucracy and red tape.
But oh, no.
Nothing compared to that.
I mean, Australia is interesting because each state is different, but New South Wales was the original convict state and still has healthy convict-style bureaucracy behind it. So I had this idea I would wanting to set up a brewery in the Blue Mountains. I was continuing to work in Sydney, so I was commuting, I think, 200 kilometres a day to get to work. And I tried for years, but, I mean, never before in my life, Kim, had I ever come across something where there was no outside the box. There was just the box. It didn't matter how creative, how charming, how innovative you tried to go about doing things. It was just the bureaucracy was so rigid. The individuals.
What did you want to do that they had most problems with?
Oh, I mean, look, I wanted to set up a brewery with a cellar door in the Blue Mountains, and I probably shouldn't go into any of this because I could go on for hours and it isn't desperately interesting. I did discover that I could gazump the local council regulations, which prevented me from manufacturing and retailing from the same premise and wholesaling. You couldn't do all of those same things in the same premise if I found a heritage listed building. And I think I got so achingly close to it about 7 times, but something would always happen that just like would prevent it. Discovering, you know, $500,000 worth of friable asbestos in the building. There was one building where I almost got the council approval and somebody found out that they'd seen a spotted quoll in the bush nearby, which meant that I couldn't do any of the development there.
Yeah,
fair enough. There aren't that many spotted quolls left.
No.
And I mean, it just went on and on. So I got to a point where really I've always tried to just keep going. I think that's the thing to do in life. If you want to achieve something,
Well, you didn't keep going. You threw in the towel and came to New Zealand.
Well, I kept going until really I got to that point where I was like, this is probably self-destructive. And I came over to visit my brother.
Well, you've got to know when to quit. That's the thing,
isn't
it?
You do, don't you? So I came to to visit my brother, Ian, who was he's 11 years younger than me and was working in Wellington at the time. The thing that kind of prompted it was I was working for Lion Nathan in Australia and I heard that Lion had pulled the Max Brewery out of Wellington.
Mm.
Now, Wellington was fascinating. This was 2008, 2009. 57% of all the craft beer in New Zealand was drunk in Wellington at that time. I'm not quite sure what the figure is now, but think about the size of Wellington. You know, it's a couple of 100,000 people and 57% of all the craft beer was consumed here. And yet there was no brewery. And I came over and I just was like, this just seems like the most amazing opportunity, this vacuum that's been created. There's no brewery here, but all these people drinking craft beer. So I went round all the bars and I was like, why are there no breweries here? And none of them seemed to have a good reason for it, other than maybe the real estate was expensive, the rents were high. I went to council and I said, would you try and stop me? Because obviously I was quite paranoid by this point. And they said, no, it sounds like a lovely idea. And I went to Customs and Excise and said, would you do anything nasty to me? And they said no. So I thought, okay, look, you know, why not? So I sold my house and my family and I moved over here. And within 6 months, we'd managed to get the garage up and running in
this
a strange
the
form.
In a derelict petrol station
with a 50-litre pilot plant that was making basically one keg of beer at a time. And the reason for that was twofold. One was that, you know, we didn't have that much money. So Joss Ruffle, who is my brother's lifelong friend, and myself were kind of like deeply immersed in this. We didn't have very much money, but also acutely aware that New Zealand is quite interesting. There's always been a very large number of breweries per head of population, like smaller breweries.
But not necessarily doing out out of the normal beer.
No, but making very good beer.
Yes.
Very good beer, but very true to style. And, I mean, I think I was just very aware that the last thing I wanted to do was just start another brewery. I felt like we needed to do something. I mean, it suits my style as well. I wanted to do creative things, but I also felt like, you know, we really needed to do something different. I mean, and if we did it right, something remarkable and interesting that would, you know, make us stand out as being different.
Somebody has said, Pete Gillespie, I studied journalism with you at university. We were but two expat New Zealanders in an Australian world in the 90s.
Oh, my goodness.
You did mooching along very well in those days, I might say.
Bless.
Says David.
Oh, my goodness. Hey,
but
David.
Always a brilliant mind lay behind the antics on campus. Marvellous you've turned out with Kim. Well done.
Nice.
So it sounds like you've peaked this morning.
There we go. There we go. They
Forget
found
the
me there. My past has found me out.
Somebody's asking, when are you going to make a gluten-free beer?
That is fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
All right, we experimented with this, and I mean, we'll probably take it even further, but there's actually an enzyme now that you can get naturally derived from mold, which makes it sound awful, but it's a natural enzyme which you can add to beer early in the process, and it will actually naturally degrade the gluten so that you can have, at the end of the process, a beer that I think is less than 20 parts per million, which is the gluten-free cutoff. So we did this. We trialed putting it in beer, which is one of my favorites. It's very simple lager, you know, with this beautifully sort of pared-down can that just says beer in it. So we added this enzyme to it, and we sent this trial off alongside one of our normal ones. The trial came back, and lo and behold, it was below the gluten-free level. But the fascinating thing was we got the other one back, the non-trial, and it was below there too. There's something about very light-coloured lager beers that make them have much, much lower gluten. And I've heard this before, that some gluten, not people with celiacs, obviously, who
right.
can not tolerate anything, but some people who are kind of gluten intolerant to a point can still drink things like Corona because it's so light.
All right. This text came in from Sandra, whose husband is celiac.
Yeah, so that's much more serious.
Yeah.
And I mean, what we're thinking about doing is, you know, picking one of our beers, trying to do everything we can to reduce the gluten, including using this enzyme, and then printing on each batch, printing on the can what the gluten level is so that people can make their own decision about it. Mm. You can make gluten-free beer, and I mean, there are even local breweries. Kereru make a gluten-free beer. People can use things like, you know, rice, sorghum, I believe, as well, potentially. And you can get something with a reduced gluten.
Growing a beard, I am informed by a texter,
yeah.
is a privilege of professions that allow for individuality, which is pretty strange given that you're all clones
well,
of each
fun.
Other in the beer world. My husband, he or she says, is a firefighter, and much as I'd love him to have a bit of stubble, it's not okay
no,
as it affects the seal on their breathing apparatus.
Absolutely.
So
did you know that? I can tell you a little story about brewers and beards, Kim. There was a brewer in America who they brewed a beer using yeast cultivated from the beard of the head brewer. So they took samples of his beard. And they found that it had yeast. Because yeast is everywhere. It's all around us right now, Kim.
Yeah,
it's in the air.
I know.
But they brewed this beer, and it
that
actually
sounds disgusting.
It sounds terrible, and people get quite squeamish about
what
it.
What do
but
they
the
call
beer,
it? I wonder.
I
beard
can't.
Beer.
Yeah, I think they did. And tasting it though, it actually was. It's interesting. He'd been on a trip to Belgium, and the beer tasted, to me, very much like a Belgian ale. And I think what had happened was that he'd just picked that up. In a brewery in Belgium, you'd like to think he'd washed it at least one or two times before they'd done that, but maybe not.
You have a Sonic Youth track.
Yes.
Dirty Boots.
We've started very gently, haven't we, Kim?
We have. You're working up to Slayer.
Oh, shh.
We'll try
Kim,
and get them
away.
In. Oh, dear, what a shame. Run out of time. Why have you chosen Sonic Youth here?
One of the funnest nights we ever did with Garage Project was an event called Music to Brew To. Hamish McKeach, who I believe you've had
yes.
on this show.
NZSO conductor.
NZSO conductor and a great friend of Garage Project, worked with me on this and got a whole load of handpicked people from the NZSO and a collection of local musicians as well, including Luke Buddha and a few other people. And they did a set, three sets of classical music where they played classical interpretations, renditions of, first of all, Dead Kennedy songs, because we have a beer called California Uberalis. So they did a whole lot of Dead Kennedy songs, all played on violin, cello. It was incredible.
Wow.
The next set were all Stranglers tunes, and we served that with Golden Brown. And then I did a special beer called Dirty Boots, and they played Sonic Youth, and it was incredible. People stage dived at the end of it. It was wonderful.
We'll be right back.
Dirty Boots, Sonic Youth. I'm talking to Pete Gillespie. So 400 beers, you reckon, or over 400 beers you've made.
Yeah.
How many of them are out there? Or do you say,
currently,
this isn't a goer, we'll forget about that one?
Oh, you know, it often isn't even that. We just, I like to be creative, and I like to constantly be trying to do new things. But obviously, you know, as you grow as a business, it creates a tension. You can't just be doing that. You need to, and also, I mean, when we first started, we actually genuinely thought about never having any kind of core beers. But, you know, people just get pissed off if they can't get the beer that they love.
Yeah.
So we started, you know, almost organically a core range grew. And so, you know, that's grown over the years. And we probably think of it as layers. We have, you know, some beers which are always available, some which kind of cycle in and out, and then this nursery bed where we're constantly trying to do kind of cool new things. And the fun ones that really resonate will continue to grow.
So what's this? You've got three sites now. You've got the Arrow Garage,
hence
the name.
Yep.
You've got Hawke's Bay.
So Hawke's Bay, yeah, we partnered with a group up there, and we brew beer up there. We send brewers up.
Different sorts of beer.
They tend to be some of the beers that have grown in size, things like beer. If we were to produce beer at Arrow, it would fill every single tank, and we would never have a chance to
experiment. What have you got going in Marion Street, which is called Marion the Street's, Wild Workshop?
Yeah. Using the kind of wild and weird and interesting yeasts that you can use in brewing, a very traditional form of brewing, using basically sometimes what's in the air around us. I mean, if you think about it, early brewers would obviously wet the grain, you know, create this liquid, and then it was just the yeast that's in the air that would settle in and create the beer. You tend to get sour beer, and so we...
Like sourdough bread.
Like, exactly like sourdough. The process is almost identical. So we do those things away from Arrow. Arrow is our clean site. Marion Street, we're free to experiment with these wild, weird, interesting yeasts and bacteria. And, I mean, God forbid that stuff ever got out in our clean site, because it would just be disastrous.
Oh, really?
Mm.
So you get cross-infection, cross-contamination?
If you got cross-contamination, say, with something like Brettanomyces, if you think of normal brewer's yeast as being like a domesticated sheep, Brettanomyces is like
feral.
A wild goat.
Oh.
And if it gets loose, then trying to get rid of it, very easy to invite in, very, very difficult to get rid of it.
Where did you get it from in the first place?
It's all around us. I mean,
you can
find it.
So how do you keep it out of
How do we keep it
places?
Out? I mean, when people are working at our Marion Street site, we have foot baths. You don't go and, you know, if you've been working there, you don't go and hang out at RO afterwards.
But if it's everywhere?
If it's everywhere, well, cleaning, being very clean. People think of brewing as being very glamorous sometimes, very creative. 95% of it is cleaning things. It really is.
Yep.
You're doing a lot of scrubbing, a lot of hot sterilising,
cleaning.
Oh, you
could have been a brain surgeon.
Is there a lot of cleaning involved there as well?
There is yet time.
Maybe my hand's too shaky for that, Kim.
Now you've got that. Just have another beer, it'll be fine. You've got time to tell me about this weird experiment that you carried out that I am deeply sceptical about.
I'm looking at the time. We are running out. It went
yeah.
so quickly. So we did an experiment. You've heard, I had heard about winemakers playing music for their yeast and their winemaking. So we did an experiment where we submerged a speaker in one of our tanks. So it was inside the beer. And we, first of all, Hamish McKeach made us this wonderful playlist of classical music designed to sort of stimulate the yeast. And it was remarkable. It played this music to the yeast. The beer fermented 10% more. The yeast performed 10% better than it was meant to. And we dry hopped it, which is where you put a little bit of hop in to the finished product, and we got this amazing flavour out of it, even though we used a tiny amount.
I suspect
it's the vibration more than anything that creates.
Well, here's a tip for all those home brewers. Let's play the music.
All right, and we'll talk afterwards.
All right.
Thank you.
That's all right. That's quite enough. Mahler's Symphony Number 5. Okay, so you played your beer that.
And play you the beer reckon. That. And you know what? There's now a group up at Auckland University who, off the back of this, are now doing experiments onto sound and its effect on yeast.
There's no reason why the vibrations wouldn't affect the yeast.
I think it maybe keeps them active longer, keeps them in suspension, so they keep working and they will continue to eat the sugar in the wort longer. So that's fascinating. So we did that, and then for our, inspired by that experiment, for our 666th brew, we decided that we would do something a little bit different. So the same idea, submerged speaker, but instead of a classical playlist, we had this.
Slayer, evil has no boundaries. And what effect did that have on your beer?
In this case, it wasn't quite the same, but mostly because we had a food-grade plastic bag around the speaker, which inflated because a little bit of work got in, so the CO2 inflated it and it came up like a balloon. So not a true experiment.
No.
But we did. We played 11 days non-stop, no repeat, death, dark and doom metal. It was chronologically ordered, made for us by Jimmy Baird, who is our death metal consultant.
You reckon? There was, I mean, the only way to prove that is to do Mahler on the same beer, exactly the same beer.
Exactly.
And then do Slayer.
Some of the brewers got quite disturbed by the death metal because you'd be in the brewery late at night, very quiet, and all you'd hear are these noises coming out of the tank. It was great.
Oh.
I loved it.
You've got time for a quick blast of Nana Muscuri, but why?
Because I wanted to talk to the art for this, which obviously, I mean, the art is in this book. We have a beer called Tournesol, which is a French saison with a touch of lemon peel, coriander. And the art is this wonderful image of Nana Muscuri running through a field of sunflowers. I'd like to think we're the only brewery in the world that has that. And it's, I thought, a nice little antidote after Slayer.
This is Nana Muscuri. We'll go out with Nana, actually. Le Tournesol. Pete Gillespie of Garage Project. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, my pleasure.
Tu ne sais que fermer les yeux. C'est ce que chantait un oiseau.
Thank you, Nana. And Pete Gillespie tells me there's going to be an exhibition of their beer art, their beer label art, at their Kingsland Garage door in Auckland at the end of the month.